Yeah, welcome. As you may recall, we're in the process of looking at various proofs of the interpolation property in classical propositional logic. There was one place where I conspicuously got stuck yesterday. I mean, we managed to get over it, but there was something unexpectedly difficult along the way. I now figured out why that was. So let's recall the definition of uniform interpolation. So the data for uniform interpolation are a formula phi and a set of atoms occurring in phi. And we basically want to extract all the information out of phi that only relates to those atoms in A. So now I'm going to avoid a notational mistake I made yesterday, namely using different letters here than in the definition of vanilla interpolation. So the interpolant is going to be named chi now. So chi is a uniform interpolant for these data, that is, of phi and with respect to A, if and only if a number of conditions hold. Now, the first is, like yesterday, chi mentions only atoms that are in A. Chi is a consequence of phi. And lastly, for all formulas psi, if psi is a consequence of phi and, let's use a different letter than for the object and here, and the atoms of psi are contained in A, that is yesterday's definition, I'm intentionally leaving room here, then psi is a logical consequence of chi. Okay, we did make it work with that definition yesterday, eventually. The more standard definition says this. Of course, that doesn't change anything. Phi here, of course. So what happens if I add this intersection here is I have a lot more formulas psi here for which I actually have to prove this this entailment. Under this definition, basically the implication a uniform interpolant is also an interpolant is completely for free, because I already have all the formulas psi that are candidates there for the uniform interpolation property. I already have them in here in this property. So this is exactly what I demand in the definition of interpolation. The only thing I additionally claim is that the chi shouldn't depend on psi, it should only mention on the joint atoms that psi and phi share. But then, of course, now I have to prove more, right? I have strengthened this definition of uniform interpolation, and now my totally stupid definition of the interpolant, namely taking chi to be the conjunction of all conjunctive normal forms psi such that First of all, phi entails psi, and secondly, the atoms of psi are contained in A. Well, that definition now no longer makes it immediate that this is really a uniform interpolant, because I'm only claiming that my uniform interpolant implies all such phi that are, such psi that are entailed by phi and have atoms at most those in A. While for this property, I need to show this for all psi that do not share any atoms with phi other than the ones contained in A. All right, so these are much more. So all this work that I had to do last time in proving that a uniform interpolant is actually an interpolant, when I had omitted this bit here, this would now have to be done for this thing here separately. And of course, it would run exactly the same way. For the slightly less brutal approach, where I had introduced this existential quantifier, so this was version A, let's call this version B, right? For version B, nothing changes. Version B was this one. Where chi was just lots of existential quantifiers prefixed before phi, where A1 up to AK are those names that occur in phi, or those atoms that occur in phi, but not in A. So that works entirely unchanged. The whole proof proceeds as before, except that in clause 3, I now have to pay more attention. When I show that this here is a uniform interpolant, I now have to have fewer restrictions or weaker restrictions on the formula psi, of which I want to show that it's entailed. And the key property that made this proof work was this. If I have a logical entailment from phi to psi, and the atom A is not mentioned in psi, then exists A dot phi entails psi. So this was the form in which I proved it. And this will suffice also to prove our new stronger goal. All we have to do is check that if A is one of these, so it's an atom of phi but not an A, that it then doesn't occur in psi. But here we are assuming that A is, we don't want intersection, but equality. Right, so we know that these A, they are an at phi. So if one of them was also an atom in psi, then it would be in this intersection here, and therefore it would be an A. So that's all we need to know, right? So all these named atoms here that we quantify out, none of them is an atom in psi. And that's all we need. Okay, so much for clarifying the slight hiatus yesterday. Okay, now we're going to do pursue a different approach to finding now just interpolants, just to show how we cannot train them proof theoretically by induction over proofs. So, right. So basically, in this case, well, here we're looking at, I mean, because we're talking about interpolation only, we are looking at an entailment between two formulas, phi and psi, so we already know the psi. And we know that this entailment is equivalent to provability of the corresponding sequent. So instead of looking at this semantically, we can also just grab this object here, which basically tells us there is a sequence-style proof of this entailment, and do induction over that proof. And, well, yeah, it's sort of pointless now that I've already proved an even stronger property semantically several times. But, like I said, I mean, this is something that will also work in other logics for which maybe this semantic approach will not necessarily work. In particular when, and as it turns out, in some cases, we don't even have a semantics, or at least not one that's easily communicated. Okay, so we'll do this via a lemma, and the lemma is going to claim something stronger than that. Well, first, only slightly stronger. Evidently, when we're working in a sequence system and we're planning to do induction proofs, then we should claim something about proper sequence and not just about sequence that have a single formula on the left and on the right. It's evident that as we proceed in the proof, we're going to have to say something about actual sequence. So we claim that in this case, whenever gamma entails psi is derivable, then there exists a formula chi such that gamma entails chi is derivable. Chi entails delta is derivable. I'll be omitting this is derivable that I'm reading out now, right? Whenever I write down a sequent without further comment, I mean it's derivable. And the atoms of chi are those, only those that occur on both sides of the original sequence, sequent. Okay, so this is clearly stronger than the previous claim, or the claim that I've made only implicit, namely the one that we have uniform that we have interpolation replacing this sign here equivalently with this one, right? It will turn out that this isn't sufficient as yet in order to carry out the induction, and it is rather apparent in this strange format of the sequence. Again, it looks fishy to work in a sequence system, but here claim something about sequence that have singleton right-hand or left-hand sides. So we should have something even more general, and that is the following. Well, first of all, we have basically a dividing line here between two sets of formulas. And formulas migrate across that line applying the rules. Namely, whenever we apply one of the negation rules, a formula will migrate from one side of this turnstile to the other. So it seems natural to basically detach this dividing line between the two sequents from the actual entailment sign, and that's what we're going to do. So That is, whenever, did I want to number them this way? Did I want to use, yeah. Whenever, well, we have the same situation, but we give ourselves a splitting of both the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the turnstile into two sub-multi-sets of formulas. Then, okay, now we want to squeeze in the chi again. Basically we want to split this into two entailment, where in each case we keep only half the formulas, basically. So, basically, we grab the first half on both sides, so take gamma 1 and delta 1, and put the, wait, no, other way around. Here one doesn't go right. It doesn't matter, of course, but you get messed up. So, and I'm putting the chi on the right here, so this generalizes this bit here. And I grab the second half, gamma 2 and delta 2, and this time I squeeze in the chi on the left. And of course, the atoms of chi are as prescribed, which means in this case they follow the splitting into the two halves. So there are only those atoms that appear in both halves. Is that what I want? No. I think it should be like this. Okay, hopefully that's right. We'll see as we actually proceed with the proof. Notes are overrated. Notes are wrong anyway. So this is the current form of the claim. So the chi basically uses only atoms that occur on both sides of the turnstile. So notice how the in this case, I hope that's right, the splitting with regard to sharing the atoms happens at a different level than the splitting of my two sides of the secret. Okay, and we're going to prove this by induction over the derivation of this split sequent here. Okay. Right, induction over that derivation just means I now go through all the sequent rules that I have and check that it works. Okay, good sanity check for the whole thing. We'll need to try the axiom rule first. Okay, so in this case, things look like this. Okay, and now things get slightly messy because just writing down the sequent down there, I mean, it looks apparent on which side the active formula, in this case the A, is going to end up, but it of course that's an error, right? So we don't know how the splitting is actually meant. So do we mean this? Do we mean A to end up in the second part, or do we mean A to end up in the first part? So, and we have to do a case distinction on this. So let's do this by underlining, right? So, so this means that in this case, I mean A to end up, well, and I've got to do this case distinction two times, right? Okay, so I will roughly be claiming that there are only two really different cases, namely that A ends up in the same part on both sides and that A ends up in different parts on both sides. So let's first do the case where A ends up in the same part, right? So in on both sides, A is in the second part. Okay, now we have to find, and I've got this somewhere here. We have to find a formula A, chi, that will basically interpolate the splitting. So, we need chi such that, I won't say anything about the atoms because the chi that we find will actually have very few atoms, to say the least. Such that what holds? We need to pick out the first half, which is just gamma 1 and delta 1. So this is the first property that we need. We get chi on the right for the first half of the splitting. And chi on the left for the second half of the splitting, where, however, on both sides, we have the A sitting in there, right? So, because that's how we defined our splitting. So let's call this little thing case one, right? All right, fine. Here we look good, right? So this is certainly derivable no matter how we choose chi, because we've got A on both sides. So now all we have to do is choose chi in such a way that this becomes derivable. Well, easy. Chi can be just true. Then this is certainly derivable because we have true on the right-hand side. Okay, something that I would technically still have to establish, but... which, of course, brings up the fact that we forgot to include a rule for bottom, right? So, this is the rule for bottom. Okay, and using that rule and the fact that top is just not true, well, applying negation once, I bring it to the left-hand side and then apply this rule. So that was sort of forgotten the whole setup. Well, of course, we could equivalently assume that bottom is just defined and then we can derive it. Okay, so that was the first case. Then there's a symmetric case where A ends up in the first half of the sequence on both sides. So that works dually. Of course, in this case, I pick chi to be equal to false. I said I didn't have to worry about the atoms because, well, chi just doesn't have any, right? In the other case, neither. So case two, the properly different one, is where the A ends up in different halves on the both sides, right? So that looks like this. Say it ends up in the second half on the left-hand side, and in the first half on the right-hand side. So now we need a chi such that what? The first halves become derivable if I stick in chi on the left. And the second halves become derivable if I stick in chi on the right. So notice how the A ends up here on the right and here on the left, because that's how I underlined it there. And now, since now we're not going to end up with a chi that doesn't mention any atoms at all. And did I do this wrong?
I think you switched it up with the chi. At least it's different from
pain. Oh, of course. Yeah, no. The chi should be on the right here and on the left here. Right. In the second half, it's supposed to be on the left. Yeah. Okay, and the atoms of chi should be... And now this is the first test of whether I wrote this condition here right. Let's hope for the best. So they should be in the atoms of gamma 1, gamma 2, and A intersect the atoms of A delta 1 and delta 2. Okay, now this already gives an indication because, I mean, the only atom of which I can be sure that it's in this intersection is A. About all the other things, I don't know anything. So it damn well better be A. And, well, what can we pick? Clearly, we can pick chi equals not A. If we pick chi equals not A, then both these things are clearly derivable because then I can bring the chi to the other side. There it becomes an A, and here it becomes an A on the right, and then these are both instances of the axiom rule. Right, so no problem. And so if I pick chi equals not A, then clearly this condition on the atoms is also satisfying. Fine. Right, now here. Okay, so that was the induction base, if you will. So now let's do one of the actual induction steps. Okay, let's do the right and rule, for instance, and not and negation. So in this case, I split the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, I get not phi, delta 1, delta 2. Okay, and again, I get two cases. But, of course, these cases are now not properly different. So I get the case that the not phi ends up in the first half, so I attach it to the delta 1, and it ends up in the second half, which means I attach it to the delta 2. But, so like I said, I'm now going to be going to do both of them, but because I can basically move formulas across the turnstile by means of negation, it doesn't make a big difference. So we'll only do this once. So this is case one, in which case the splitting is like this, so not phi ends up in the first half. Okay, and we conclude this from this sequence here, where we've moved phi to the left. Okay. Now, to this thing here, we can apply the induction hypothesis, because this has a shorter proof. So now, the acrobatics start. Here, I'm not given a splitting, although it might look like that, because it has these suggestive numbers sitting around there. But no. I know that for any old splitting that I decree for this sequent here, I get an interpolate. So I can just make up one. And the moment, this is where one can make actual mistakes. So let's briefly remember how I wanted to do this. I now pick that splitting which actually puts phi in the first half, obviously. I'm saying obviously, I'm hoping it works, but I've got it on paper somewhere, but I think it's just faster to do it directly. Wait a moment, do we have... No, we don't have colored chalk. So notice how the electrical engineers trust their students not to mess up the rooms with colored chalk if they just leave it lying around. In room E111, we had colored chalk this morning. So... So we pick this splitting here. We attach the phi to the first half in this sequent. And by the induction hypothesis, we have chi such that a number of properties hold, namely the first half of the sequent with chi attached to the right is derivable. Then the second half with chi attached to the left is derivable, and so now I get on the right just delta 2. And let's pay attention to the atoms. The atoms of chi are... Now this is independent of the splitting, I just look at my sequent. They're in the intersection of the left-hand side and the right-hand side. Okay, now, and this seems to indicate that I should have trusted what I put on paper in my notes. So these, I remember thinking about this actually. So this is wrong. This must really be delta 1 here and gamma 2 here. We've already done one step, so let's check this back. In this case, we get delta 1 here. And gamma 2 here. So this still has the same intersection, so at least it still has A in the intersection, so this works fine. And here we correct it. So this becomes delta 1 and gamma 1, delta 1, and, well, not phi, of course, which is the same as with respect to atoms as phi. And here we get the second half, which is just gamma 2, delta 2. Well, okay. Yeah, picking induction invariants is a bit tricky. So, yeah, not trusting your own notes. Well, okay, so this is now what we get by the induction hypothesis for our newly modified inductive claim, which is now in correspondence with my written notes again. So the atoms of chi are those that occur in both halves of the splitting, okay, rather than on both sides of the turnstile. Right. Now, what do I have to show? I have to show that the chi also provides me an interpolant for the splitting of this bottom thing here. So, and I probably have to negate it, right? So I want it on the right. That means... no, I think I can just use it. So first I look at the first half of the splitting, so that's gamma 1 here. And not phi, delta 1, and chi on the right. That, of course, is by which rule? Well, by the right rule for negation. Because I have this, I can just push the phi to the right, and then it becomes not phi. What else? The other part of the splitting. Gamma 2 with chi on the left entails delta 2. Well, that I just copy from here, no problem. And now the tricky bit about the atoms, right? So the atoms of chi, now write down what should happen, and then I'll check that it actually does happen. So what should happen is that the atoms of chi, according to our new inductive claim, are contained in both halves of the splitting. So they're in the intersection of gamma 1, comma, not phi delta 1, that's the first half, intersect atoms of the second half. And yes, that seems to work, because now this is basically exactly the same expression here up to the ordering of the atoms, the formulas. Okay, fine. Right, now I'm going to do the other case. So again, we're looking at the right rule for negation. But now, not phi sits in the second half. And we've concluded this from the same sequence. Gamma 1, gamma 5, phi, gamma 1, gamma 2, phi entails delta 1, delta 2. Okay, again, I get to pick a splitting of the premise. And now I follow the same guideline. I attach the main formula to the same half as the principal formula was attached here in the conclusion. So I pick this splitting. Okay, now what I get is a formula chi by the inductive hypothesis such that three things hold. First half of the splitting with chi on the right. So gamma 1 entails chi comma delta 1. Second half of the splitting, which now has the phi in it, with chi on the left, entails delta 2. And atoms at chi is contained in the atoms of the first half of the splitting, that's gamma 1 delta 1 intersect the atoms of the second part. That's gamma 2, not phi, delta 2. Okay. Now let's see that this does the job. Again, the same chi. So again, the first line we can just copy. Well, not again. Last time we could just copy the second line. So this is already as it should be. Then the second half, which has gamma 2, we put in the chi, and this should entail the second half here, which has not phi and delta 2. And, well, this is not quite what we need yet compared to here, but we get it by, again, the right rule for negation from this bit here. And let's again write down where the atoms of chi are supposed to live. Atoms of the first half are gamma 1, delta 1, and atoms of the second half are gamma 2, not phi, delta 2. And comparing it to this, again, we're taking exactly the same intersection, so we're fine with regard to chi. Okay. Yeah, we have a lot of rules and we have a lot of cases, right? For this rule now, the left rule for negation, I am actually going to do one of the cases, although it's nearly symmetric, but along the way we'll see that we actually have to change the interpolant coming from the premise of the rule. So I'm going to do one of those two cases. So in this case, we have the not phi on the left, and the case I'm going to pick, doesn't matter, is the one where not phi is attached to the second half, entails delta 1, delta 2, derived from the same sequence with phi shunted to the right and negation removed. Okay, now I need to pick a splitting of this thing here. I follow the same policy that we now know, so I attach phi to the second half, as in the conclusion. So now, by the inductive hypothesis, I get an interpolant for this splitting up here. So, what's that? We have the first half where the phi doesn't appear, so we just have gamma 1 entails chi, comma delta 1. Then we have the second half where we do get the phi. So we have gamma 2 with chi added on the left entails phi, comma, delta 1. And, well, actually, I'll omit the calculation about the atoms, right? It works exactly the same way as before. Where, of course, I've been inserting typos here. This negation here, of course, isn't there. right? Because I've been splitting something that doesn't have negation in there, but of course the negation doesn't matter because it doesn't contribute to the atoms. Okay, so this calculation is exactly as before. Now what we have to check is what happens in terms of the entailments that we get. So, what we need is well, actually, nothing special happens. I thought it would, actually. Okay, nothing special happens. We just copy the first line, and for the second line, well, we know the drill by now. Well, this is, of course, a typo. This must be delta 2. For the second line, we just move the phi to the left, so we have gamma 1, not phi, chi, entails delta 2. Okay, nothing special. Everything works basically as before. Okay, so we'll stop it there, at least for the negation rules. This is getting old, so let's wipe it. Okay, so just for the heck of it, let's do a rule with two premises. For the left and rule, right? I think this should by now be evident how this works, right? I mean, the left and rule behaves like these rules and in fact even simpler. All I have to do is just to transfer the interpolant from the premise to the conclusion, nothing much happens. So the right rule is slightly more interesting. I think we'll do that here. Yes, so my claim that the right rule is more interesting is actually in agreement with my notes, so let's do that one. So how does this work? So we derive something that has a conjunction to the right of the turnstile. From two premises that just have one of the conjuncts on the right-hand side of the turnstile each. So got the two missing here. So it's a bit lengthy now due to the splitting. So this is gamma 1 and gamma 2 entails phi delta 1 delta 2. And gamma 1, gamma 2 entails psi delta 1, delta 2. Okay. Now, of course, I have to fix the two cases. So this is case 1. And I mean, now they're properly different because the rules are no longer that symmetric, right? So we have to do them both. So let's do the case first where we attach the principal formula to the first half of the sequence. Then we have to pick a splitting of the premises, two of them, right? So in both cases, we pick a splitting, and we pick the one, I mean, following the policy that we know by now, where we attach the active formulas to the first half as well. So these two. So now, of course, we get two interpolants, one for the left premise and one for the right-hand premise. So we have chi and rho such that, okay, now six properties now. First, chi is supposed to be the one for the left premise, so we get the first half, which includes the phi. So we get gamma 1 entails chi phi delta 1. In the second half, we get the chi on the left, no mention of phi. Similarly, now the rho, right, that's totally symmetric, except that I switch out phi for psi. So that's gamma 1 entails chi psi delta 1, and gamma 2 chi entails delta 2. Rho, thank you. Yeah. So this is the second interpolant rho for the right-hand premise, right? Okay, and then the conditions on the atoms. One for chi, one for rho. Okay, so the atoms for chi are contained in both sides of the splitting of the left premise. So that's atoms of gamma 1 phi delta 1 intersect atoms of gamma 2 delta 2, and for rho, the same, just with phi swapped out for psi. Okay, and now we have to find our joint interpolant for the conclusion. And we're going to do something unsurprising. Namely, we're just going to form the conjunction of our two interpolants, the previous ones. So now I want I should look at my notes. Right, turns out that's the case that isn't in my notes. So, all right. Okay, now I need to apply weakening. Because right now I cannot really do anything to combine these sequence here, because they don't have exactly the right, the same things sitting on the left and on the right. So what I'm going to do is what? Here. Ah, right. So let's do some derivations here, starting with the second line. So these cannot yet be combined, but I can do some back and forth shifting to derive something. So first of all, I can apply negation. And I can do that here as well. Now all of a sudden I can combine them, because now I can apply the right rule for conjunction. So I get this, right? Not chi and not rho. Now this isn't quite what I need in the end, because for the second half I need the interpolant on the left. Well, no problem. I just negate the thing, move it to the left, and this entails delta 2. Okay, clearly what we recognize here is the disjunction of chi and rho. And we need to get the other thing as well. So again, some shifting back and forth. Right, this is to this part. So first of all, I start shifting chi and rho to the left in these first two bits. And the other one as well. So what I get is that gamma 1 and not chi entails phi comma delta 1, and gamma 1 comma not rho entails psi comma delta 1. Now I apply weakening, it's in this part that this happens. So weakening on the left, I can just add arbitrary stuff here to the left. For instance, I can add not rho, not chi here, and not rho there. Right? So gamma 1, not chi, and not rho entails phi delta 1. And the same thing entails psi delta 1, by the same maneuver, just adding the other missing bit. And taking those two together, again with the right rule for conjunction, but now applied to our original formulas, gives me gamma 1, not chi, not rho, entails phi and psi comma delta 1. Okay, we're getting there. Yeah, I guess we can now wipe these. Okay. So, where are we? Down there. So, now I've got two things to the left of the turnstile entailing something. Well, I can join them using the left rule. So that's an interesting effect. So far, in order to establish an interpolant in the other cases, I've always only ever needed the same rule as the one that I was currently in. Now I actually need both rules for and, left and right. So we get gamma 1 not chi and not rho entails phi and psi comma delta 1. And then we shift it to the right. That's not right, the rule. Gamma 1 entails not chi and not rho, again recognizable as chi or rho, comma delta 1. Oof. So, and that's the same formula as we received here. It remains to calculate the condition on the atoms. So, we're looking at, do the brackets close? Yes. So we're looking at the atoms in this thing here. Well, these are just the atoms that occur in chi or in rho. So this is at chi union at rho. And now let's check that this is contained in both sides of the original splitting. So this is contained in what? Let's first write down the claim and then see that it actually follows. So this is supposed to be at gamma 1 comma, and now the conjunction here ended up in the first half, so it goes here. Phi and psi delta intersect, and the second part didn't have the conjunction, so that's just gamma 2 delta 2. Okay, let's check this. So basically, we have to check that the atoms of chi are contained in that right-hand side. Yeah, that's a good idea, actually. So we have to check the atoms of chi are contained in that right-hand side. And yes, that works because the atoms of chi are, well, they're contained in the atoms of the second part of the splitting. That's already here. And they're also contained even in gamma 1, in the atoms of gamma 1 phi delta 1, which are less than this here. I mean, this looks like an intersection, but when I look at the atoms, it's really a union, right? So these are the atoms that occur in either phi or psi. Well, they occur even in phi specifically. And the same, of course, goes for rho, where the atoms end up specifically in gamma 1 or delta 1 or in psi, and in particular are contained in this conjunction here. So that works fine. So I don't want to bore you to death, so I'll just say that the case two for the AND rule, which is the one that I have in my notes, so I can confirm that I've actually done it, unlike this one, works as well, but gives me a different interpolant, namely, it actually gives me chi and rho, while this here gave me chi or rho for the other splitting. So, what happens is, if we check all this, we assemble the interpolants along the proof. So remember, in the base, we had two very simple cases. Either we actually had top or bottom or A, well, actually four cases, top or bottom or A or not A. Those were the four cases that we got out of the atom rule, depending on how we arranged the splitting. And then in each step of the proof, we just take the interpolant from the conclusion from the premise and just inherit it to the conclusion unchanged. That's most cases, namely all cases for the not rule, although I was originally claiming that there would be a not entering somewhere, but that doesn't actually seem to happen. And also for the and left rule, we just inherit the interpolant from the premise. That is fairly clear because if we look at if we look at what happens here, right? We have this formula, well, either in gamma 2 or in gamma 1. Correspondingly, we either put both of these in with gamma 2 or with gamma 1. We get an interpolant, and of course, we can use the exact same interpolant for the thing down here, because it doesn't really matter whether we put phi and psi in with gamma 2 or phi comma psi in with gamma 2. Right? So for that rule, the interpolant just stays unchanged. What happens, slightly puzzlingly, is that the interpolant is linear in the target formula, which somehow can't happen, right? But I mean, there seems to be no significant increase here, no blow-up of any kind, none that I could detect.
Why shouldn't it happen?
Well, I mean, if we remember what happens when we put lots of existential quantifiers in front of a formula and then expand that out, I mean, that's an exponential blow-up. So I've never thought about this previously. It must just occur to me while conducting this proof. I mean, it seems to me that if I look at the proof, right, I follow. I mean, it seems there's an inductive claim that if I construct an interpolant along a proof of this kind, then the interpolant that I get is always linear in the principal formula, right? Well, no, that's not quite right because. Okay, no, that was also too good to be true, so it doesn't happen. So the best thing that we can do, actually, I mean, there's no notion of principal formula in a sequence, so we cannot assume that this here is some sort of principal formula in the sequence. It's not. We don't know what happens. And the best that we could hope to prove is that the interpolant is linear in the overall size of the sequence. But that doesn't happen because here in this room, we get something that's linear. I mean, but if we try to do this by induction, we get something that's linear in the size of this thing, then something that's linear in the size of this thing, and then we join them. But these two things, they're almost as large as this one. So a rough estimate is that the interpolant down here is twice the size. So that doesn't work. Okay, I'm happy again, because that would really have puzzled me. Anyway, we construct the interpolant recursively along the proof. So, I mean, we only claim that it exists, but it's really an inductive construction that, given a proof, a sequence-style proof, will allow you to extract an interpolant recursively from the proof. And the one thing that does happen is that what we construct is already an NNF. Right, because the only place we ever get negation is at the atoms. We get not A as one of the cases for the Exim rule. And otherwise, we just either copy the interpolant or form it using conjunction or disjunction, unless there's negation hiding in the one case that I didn't do for one of the not rules. But I mean,
what we just discussed is you right now, we're with all the cases we did, there doesn't seem to be the possibility that the formula contains an atom without a negation in front of it. because
the formula that we get is an interpolant.
Yeah.
We didn't do the one case where we get a non-negated atom. So I've already that's in the axiom case, obviously. So so it's just from a different splitting of the axiom rule,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
The one where they end up on the same side,
right,
but
so because there were four cases actually.
No, wait. With the one where they end up on different sides, but the other way around, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so so that was a glimpse of the vast field of proof theory. What you see here is it can be a bit tedious, so I repeat this saying that if you like long inductions over syntax, then you don't need semantics. Recall how quickly these semantic proofs went, right? But still, I mean, the advantage of having a syntactic proof, on the other hand, is that it's more definitely algorithmic, right? Although, of course, I mean, in propositional logic, where everything's immediately decidable anyway, I mean, you can't really tell the difference very much. Well, immediately in the sense that you can, I mean, all this has exponential blow-up, so it's computationally infeasible anyway, right? But... I mean, in theory, in practice, you can still do it. But I mean, it's very easy to see that the decision procedures, because nothing is conceptually very hard. I mean, it's a conceptually easy logic, by comparison. Okay, mind you, there's these interpolants. I mean, having an exponential blow up is a harmless. Is harmless by comparison. So, for instance, if you look at the logic EL, which is it's a description logic, so a particular modal logic, a field on which we're going to start next week, which is the underlying logic of the world's largest medical ontology, SNOMED CT. Well, EL does have interpolation, yes. I think even uniform, if I'm not quite mistaken. But I think it has triply exponential blow up, something like that. So, yeah. So having singly exponential blow up is nothing, right? So no problem at all. Okay. That is more or less all I wanted to do today. We have a topic that is sitting there on algebraic semantics, but maybe we'll just skip that for the time being, because there's no way to do algebraic semantics in 50 minutes. Right? So, are there any questions? I imagine maybe there are, because this has been heavy going, I realize that. Or was it just boring? Okay, otherwise I would say there is no harm in going home early today. We're going to start on modal logic the next week. We should hurry up with the sheets. I'm going to hand out the sheet on Tuesday, I guess, so we can just cover the topics as we go along, so you should see the sheet as early as possible. We have the handling of the current sheet next week on, what did I put on the sheet? Tuesday, right. So feel free to ask any questions if they come up. Now, maybe? Everybody happy with the current sheet? Also with the induction and the admissibility proof. Okay, good. Looking forward to that. So, see you guys next week.